This is Armand DeMille with you at the Positive Mind, WBAI, 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Positively minded. Kind of an interesting thing, you know, because we have a great opportunity today. I want to welcome Mark Matuszek. Mark, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you.
Oh, I can't hear you. There you go. Try again.
Thanks.
Mark Matuszek, just a comment you made a couple of minutes ago, Mark, about why you're enjoying this is your first of your radio interviews. The book comes out tomorrow, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's great to be here, and I love that I'm on a program called The Positive Mind for this book in particular.
The name of the book, When You're Falling, Dive, Lessons in the Art of Living. And for those of you, my friends out there, who think you can't possibly get by based on information you receive and trying to balance and physical challenges and losing people and oppression, this is quite a remarkable exploration. Now, Mark, before we get into the book about, which is a book about survival and survival of the soul, as well as other survivals, I want to do your background because I thought that was really fabulous. Just so people should know, you're an author and you've written two other books.
Yes, yes.
Can we talk about that?
Well, my first book was called Sex, Death, Enlightenment, and it was a book about leaving the fast track. I used to work for Andy Warhol in New York. I was an editor at Interview Magazine. And in the 80s, friends started to get sick and die from AIDS. And it was really my wake-up call. I realized that I had no sort of inner life. I'd spent my time till then, like most American men, trying to make it, climbing the ladder. I had climbed the masthead at the magazine, thought I was doing really, really well. And then friends started to get sick. And although I had not been diagnosed with HIV myself, it was the wake-up call I needed to start an inner journey, to start looking into myself. I quit the magazine. I realized I'd had enough with limousine chasing and celebrities and all that kind of stuff. And I started working with a meditation teacher in Germany. I went to India with Andrew Harvey, who's a wonderful British author and friend of mine. And really started to discover that there was another dimension completely to life that I had, you know, that I was completely unfamiliar with. So after a few years, I felt qualified enough to try to describe that conversion story. So that was Sex, Death, Enlightenment. And my second book was called The Boy He Left Behind. And that was about looking for my father, who disappeared when I was a child. And I never knew him, never thought I wanted to know him because I'd been told only terrible things about him. And then when I was in my 30s, it was interesting, my late 30s, which I understand is when a lot of men start yearning for their fathers, whether they actually had one in the house or not, somebody dared me to hire a detective and have a look for him. So I did it, and it turned out to be a phenomenal experience and not the experience that I expected.
What happened? Could you tell me about it?
Well, we didn't actually find him, but it turned out that the search itself was the point. It wasn't finding this old man named Jim Matuszek. It was admitting first that I had missed not having a father, going into therapy and looking into how not having a father had affected my life, my relationships, my career, and then actually reconciling with my mom, which was not part of the picture at all. But it turned out that this absent ghost of a father had stood between us all my life.
Between you and your mom?
Between me and my mother, yeah.
Well, how does... I mean, I know we're going to go to this, but this is, I think, important, and many of the men who I relate to have this issue of manhood and what manhood is. Now, there you are, absent a father. Right now, many men I know are absent their fathers, too. Your father could be absent even if he's there.
Absolutely.
Right? What happens?
What happens? That's a long... it's a complicated question. First of all, I grew up in a house with three sisters and my mother. So I was the only... I became the man of the house when I was 4 years old. So I grew up feeling like it was my responsibility to keep the ship afloat and to make sure that everyone was okay. So you become a chronic caretaker. You feel like you have the burden of the world on your shoulders. And it doesn't occur to you as a fatherless son that you're actually playing this outsized role.
You have many roles now.
Many roles.
You're the father to your sisters. You're the husband to your mother.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you're the child who, and you're the kid who has to take out the garbage.
Yes, exactly. But the kid, it's interesting because the kid is the one that gets pushed under the carpet somehow. At least for me, I never felt like I had a childhood. That was one of my big gripes in life, is I never had that innocent time that kids talk about when there are no worries and everything is possible and you're lighthearted. I felt like I was worried from the time I was born. And so looking for my dad for me was a revelation, because I first had to admit that this had profoundly affected me. And then I'd been running from that fact my whole life. I'd been in total denial about needing a father, wanting a father. My mother used to say that I wouldn't have liked the man my father was. So it was I was all screwed up, really, when it came to who I was as a man.
My guest, Mark Matuszak. The name of the book is When You're Falling, Dive, talking about a previous book on an exploration and Mark's history here. So Mark, as a kid, like every other kid, who doesn't have a father present, you have to make up what is a man.
You do.
Now, and your mother also tells you what is a man, and your sisters tell you what is a man, so you have to create this thing like out of paper mache.
You do.
And then you have to be it.
Exactly. I mean, I can remember, I must have been 7 or 8 years old, looking in the encyclopedia and seeing a picture of the Colossus of Rhodes. And that became my archetype for what a man was, should ideally be like. Obviously, this is a 90-foot gold statue that used to straddle the harbor in Rhodes. And I thought that a man would be that sort of extraordinary, monolithic, strong sort of person who nothing bothered and who could, sort of take anything on his shoulders, like an Atlas kind of character. And I actually tried to imitate my idea of what it would be like to be that kind of a person. So you become very grandiose, and you also have you develop a skewed notion of what strength means. Strength, you think, is this is machismo, is invulnerability, is the the ability to deny your own needs. And to sort of shoulder your way through. And I had done that. I'd done it pretty well.
Pretty strong guy, right? And that's
yeah.
it. I'm a strong guy.
Yeah.
The trouble is there was a piece missing.
A huge piece.
And it's somewhere. Where is it? Where do you find it?
You find it when you start losing.
Okay.
And when you start facing mortality. And when you start not getting what you want, that's when you're broken and this fictional idea of manhood can't save you, that's when you have to start looking for the
real thing. Now, it's an interesting thing because they call it a narcissistic wound. When a young man has to make up what a father is, he creates this image of a man and he lives this image of a man, but the image of a man is like the skin on the outside of a snake when it's molting.
Right.
It's this kind of plastic skin. Mm. When it gets cracked, you could always patch it up, somebody cracks your ego, you lose a job, you lose a relationship, somebody jilts you, that's okay, you could survive that. But sometimes the crack goes through to the bone like an illness.
Exactly.
And when it does, the entire thing falls apart, and there you are, naked.
That's right.
And you have to say to yourself, which is what I see in your book, what am I really,
Exactly, exactly.
You were a survivor yourself, so you got a diagnosis, right?
I did.
What
I
happened?
Did. Well, I assumed that I was HIV positive from the age of 29 or so. I actually got the diagnosis in my early 30s, and thank God I've never been sick, and the drugs came along just in time, and I'm sort of having this second life that I didn't necessarily think that I would have. So I feel like I reaped the rewards of mortality, of a mortal threat, without actually needing to get sick, which is an extraordinary place to be. But then you find yourself in another paradoxical position, because you're going to live after you thought you weren't. And so all of the reasons that you may have secretly wanted to die have to be dealt with. All that dark stuff that you thought, oh, well, I don't have to deal with that because I won't be around. You are around. So you do have to start learning how to have a relationship and how to deal with middle age and how to, you know, be a human being. This book is about how to be a human being, which is a tall order.
Well, how to be a human being when you're under great stress. Now every one of these people, and we're going to, you just have to hear some of these stories before you really feel like you want to learn every one and learn from each one of them. People have to know, people want to know how to survive. We wonder about, how do you survive an abusive childhood? How do you survive an abusive parent? How do you survive losing a child? How do you survive losing a mate? How do you survive losing your health? How do you get through it? How do you get through it? What if, when you get really sick, what happens?
Yeah.
I remember once, this is a story I've told, I was down in Florida and I went to one of these total body imaging places where they do a scan of your whole body and they tell you what's wrong. And a guy tells me, he says, "Up, we found a spot on your lung. We think you have lung cancer. But the real doctor won't be back till Monday." So there I was at a health resort where I had the scan done. And I was convinced I had lung cancer for three days. 3 days, I had to go through quite a journey. I mean, I went in the inside. I said, okay, I'm not going to tell anybody yet. I'm going to find out what this is. By the end of the 3 days, I had this kind of a mild depression, but an acceptance. And then the guy said it was a spot on the lens. It was a mistake.
I love it.
It was like, what a beautiful story.
I love it.
Okay. But during that time, the challenge came up. A challenge that many people fear. They're afraid. People are afraid of getting sick. They're phobic. They're worried about it. And the people who worry the most about it die.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, who are the people who the people who suffer the most are the ones who are living in terror.
Right.
Let's talk about some of these people. Let's talk about some of these people and what they've gone through. And you've spoken to them all.
Yeah, sure. Well, the first chapter in the book is actually about Joan Didion, who most of your listeners must know, wrote a book called The Year of Magical Thinking after her husband died suddenly in their apartment. And she was a hero for me. So just speaking to Joan Didion was a big deal. And then seeing how open she was and how this experience had actually softened her. By her own admission.
Well, what happened? I mean, since most people didn't read the book.
Okay. I, for some reason, I think everybody's read this book. It was a few days before Christmas. I believe it was about 5 years ago. And Joan Didion and her husband, John Gregory Dunn, had one daughter named Quintana, who was in the hospital, actually, at the time, with some sort of strange septic shock thing. So they were home making dinner, and they were on their way back to the hospital after dinner. And Joan came into the living room, they sat down at the table. She handed her husband a drink. He lifted the glass to take a sip, and he died at the table. He died of a massive coronary at the table. So suddenly that she actually thought he was kidding at first. And obviously he wasn't. She called 911. And then as she describes in the book, you go into a kind of a tilted sort of state, a strange, that's why she calls the book The Year of Magical Thinking. Because even though she knew he was dead, she couldn't move his shoes from the doorstep in case he came home and he needed them. Even at the hospital, she was trying to figure out how to get him home, though she knew he was dead. So it was fascinating, she said, to realize how crazy you could be without actually being insane. And she wrote the book, she said, because she wanted to deal with what she called the American way of grief, which is evasiveness posing as courage. What she found was that people around her couldn't deal with her grief. They couldn't deal with how profoundly ruptured her psyche was from this experience. So she spent most of the time alone. And the book was an attempt to retrace exactly how this had happened to regain her footing. I loved spending time with her. But she said to herself that she's not the same person. She's more patient. She said right after he died, she said for years when she heard couples bickering, it made her very, very angry. She wanted to say, you don't have enough time. What are you doing? You don't have enough time. And I heard that was a refrain throughout the book with different survivors I spoke to, was looking at people who haven't had this sort of an experience and feeling like they're in a vacuum. They're in a kind of, they're behind a kind of veil of immortality and invulnerability. And once that veil gets pulled back, you see the world and yourself in a completely different way. And trying to, that's why I wrote this book, and trying to communicate that to people isn't always easy. They think that you're being dramatic. They think that you're being spiritual. But you're really telling the truth. And so Joan Didion was a great way to sort of start this journey.
And when you say you're really telling the truth, so reality is reality is including vulnerability into our existence, which tends to deny it. Or if it doesn't deny it, we become phobic, which I believe is another form of denial.
It is. Yeah. Yes. It absolutely is. What you realize is that you're capable of so much more than you have a clue of before something like this happens. That's what I heard over and over, is that we have muscles and capacities that are completely untouched until we have to draw on them to get through an emergency or a crisis situation. And once those capacities are touched and that tweaks that thing in your brain, you are not who you thought you were. And it's as simple as that. One guy said to me, he said, you're going to come out gold on the other side, or you're not going to come out at all. It's like going through a fire. And once you, if you're willing to change, and if you're willing to step into this larger identity that you discover through crisis, then the rest of your life post-crisis is transformed. And that's what's exciting about it.
Give me another example of it. Talk about that Tibetan nun.
I met the longest-serving the Tibetan nun who had served longest in Chinese prison. She was thrown in jail when she was 12 years old in Lhasa for chanting the equivalent of "Long live the king." She was saying "Long live the Dalai Lama."
So she went to just like she was a teenager.
She was a nun. She was a 12-year-old nun.
12-year-old nun. She goes to the meetings that they have, and that's like saying "Long live the queen."
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. There was a public rally. They were shouting "Long live the Dalai Lama." The next thing they knew, they were in the back of a truck, and they were thrown into jail for 9 months
by
the Chinese police.
So the Chinese police come and they gather her up, and here she is, this 12-year-old nun.
Yes.
Innocent.
Yes.
And she's thrown in the back of a car. What happens to her when she?
Well, she was in jail for 9 months with her fellow nuns. Then she was let out of jail, went to another rally, did the exact same thing, and she was thrown into jail for, I believe it was 12 years.
The first time she went to jail, she was brutally treated.
She was brutally treated. Yeah, it was like Abu Ghraib, the equivalent of an Abu Ghraib type of...
It was a kind of torture and try to drive it out of your mind. You're going to get this evil out of your mind. We're going to beat you. So was she beaten?
She was terribly beaten. She was electrocuted. There were rats that would let into the cell. They wouldn't let... It was the middle of the winter in Tibet, and they wouldn't let them... She was wearing just a shirt. So she was starved.
She spoke a mistruth, something I've heard about, which is they electrocute your tongue.
Yes.
They electrify your tongue.
Yes.
Just kind of to...
Yeah. And this other horrible thing called the airplane position, where they put they tie your hands behind your back and hang you from the ceiling. So it's excruciating. It's like your arms are being pulled out of the sockets. And this is a young woman. This is a young woman who...
12-year-old girl. And then she goes out there to chant again, not just out of rebellion.
Because she won't be stopped. They will not let the Chinese, you know, suppress their hope. They feel like their hope is being destroyed. And they call them splittists, the ones who are loyal to the Dalai Lama.
Mm-hmm.
And she is a devout Buddhist. And one of the Buddhist sermons says that hatred never ends by hatred. So her entire practice has been not hating the Chinese, remaining devoted to her cause, and persevering. Even now, she's in the United States now, but the last time I spoke to her, she was trying to get back there. I said, do you really want to go back there? You're safe here. Why would you want to go back there? And she said something really modest, like, there are many like me, you know, without...
So how many years in prison right? And you have to, as a 12-year-old girl being brutalized in a prison, what do you do to your mind? Well, she had a good out. She had God. You know, she had one of these very, you know, if your mind could go there, I don't know if you call it dissociation or whatever it is, you hook up to something, you disconnect from your body, and your mind survived. Now, whether that's willpower or just the body's ability to do it, I don't know. I can't really say that's courage. Whereas, to me, it's just if you have the ability to dissociate, you can get through this stuff.
That's true. I think it's more than dissociation, though. Martin Luther King said something like, in order for a life to have meaning, it needs to be devoted to something larger than ourselves. And Nawang Sangdral, who is this Tibetan nun, is the personification of that. It's really not about her. She doesn't see it as about her suffering. She sees it as about the Tibetan independence cause and loving His Holiness the Dalai Lama and devoting herself to something larger. And you see that in survivors of all kinds, is that unless you can connect to something bigger than yourself, it's very hard to get through moments when that self, that little me, has no footing. You have to connect to the identity that belongs here on Earth, no matter what, regardless of your circumstances.
And you know, Mark, if you're talking about it, many people just say, I wonder what that is he's talking about.
Yeah.
What is that thing he's talking about? Where does he get that essence? You mean you got to be faced by death in order to, or by great loss in order to find your essence? Is it a matter of finding a core in your soul that's latent and available, or do you get scared and then something comes in when you're scared? You know, is it something that comes in from the outside, like, you know, the spirit enters you when you're terrified, or is it a spirit that's latent inside your body that you wake up?
It's latent inside your body. I mean, and in my experience, it's latent. And unfortunately, denial is such, and the mind, the way the mind is constructed in such a way that it seems like crisis or catastrophe, disaster, trauma, pain, fear, loss, something counterintuitive, something counter-desirable has to happen to crack through the ego's stronghold. And when that happens, you realize that you, nothing outside of yourself, you have reservoirs of strength and courage and largesse that you really didn't have any idea you had. And that's an extraordinary thing. It's the reason that you see people, post-catastrophe people, I call them. You see people who have been through horrible things seem to enjoy life so much more than people who have had sort of protected existences or who haven't been tested. This is a huge generalization, but I have seen it in my research, and I interviewed hundreds of people.
Well, you know, one of the ways that people talk about it, they say, well, you know, once you get to appreciate life because you know it's so short. But right. But it's not the idea. The idea is not you have to hold on to life.
No, it's not that, but the impermanence definitely wakes you up. Because we operate in a trance of invulnerability most of the time, a sort of trance of immortality. I think it's how we keep alive. If you were aware of all the dangers at every moment, it would be really hard to leave the house. So there's a level of denial I think that's necessary for healthy, functional living in the world. But that becomes entrenched, and we start to forget that we really are only here for a minute, and that if that's true, so as one guy said to me, if life is a gift, the right response is thank you. So, and I don't know many people who live lives of gratitude, true gratitude, who haven't been tested in some way or had that gratitude tested in some way.
If my guest, Mark Matusik, the book When You're Falling Down, When You're Falling Dive, which I guess the title says quite a bit. You know, when you're, describe the title to me, guys.
Well, I mean, the idea is that once you're in a situation, a crisis of some kind, you can do one of two things. You can tense up, you can resist it, and you can get a lot more beaten up and go through it with a lot more damage and less skill. Or you can surrender to it. You can dive into it. Some people confuse surrender and resignation.
Mm-hmm.
Resignation is a depressive act. Surrender is a pro-life act. Surrender is a way of saying, I am part of a larger movement, and I'm going to find the most graceful, skillful, mindful way I can of getting through that situation, a situation that I can't necessarily make go away. And I find that, in my experience, that has been the only thing that helps. One of the women I talked to in the book, Dr. Rachel Remen, talks about, she's a physician herself, and she says, you see it with women in childbirth. As soon as they stop, if they're tensed up, nothing is born. They won't dilate, they can't have the baby. When you go through something major in your life, rarely is it made better, or are you helped in any way by fighting it. It just doesn't work.
You know, it reminds me of some of the stuff I've been reading about menopause, and how when people perceive menopause as a dying off, in a way, the beginning of a dying phase, and the people who see that and go at it that way are the ones who suffer the most, whereas the people who kind of, like you said, dive in. Okay, here come the next 20 years. How am I going to live it how am I going to live it at its fullest?
Exactly. Exactly. How do you see it as a birth?
Yeah, how do you see it as a birth?
There are people, you can focus on the closed door or the ending, or you can look at the open door. I mean, honestly, it's cliche, but absolutely true, that when something ends, something else really does begin. So one guy said to me, who's been through, he's like Job, he's been through so many things, but he said in the hospital he could always tell the people who were going to survive from the ones who weren't, and the ones who survived, the ones who didn't survive, were the ones who could not imagine their lives any differently than how they were before. If you can't imagine yourself differently than before the crisis or the trauma or the loss, whatever it is that shook you up, happened, you're in trouble. You're in trouble because life doesn't have a way of moving you forward. Life can't enter in because you're not allowing it to.
My guest, Mark Matuszek. When we get back from our break, we're going to be talking about some of the other stories of people. How do you survive something like the loss of a child? How do you survive different illnesses that many people have to get confronted with and deal with? You know, and it's kind of a beautiful thing. The thing I love about your book is that it's a now thing. You know, it's like, don't grab it and give it to somebody who is already sick. There's a piece of us that needs to wake up.
Absolutely.
And the waking up is not how to take care of your body better, how to go on a better diet, how to do all that. It's stop holding on, get your soul straight, get your heart straight.
Absolutely.
And I'm talking to a man who, like many men I knew, grew up having to find his own way because the roles that society gives you and the way that you're told how to get through is just through denial and overpowering.
That's right.
And that's not what seems to be the key to a masterful living, you know? And by that I mean living at its best. So we're going to come back and we're going to talk a little bit about your experience with Ram Dass, which I know was also great, and a couple of other people as well. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I'm interviewing Mark Matuszek, and we're talking about survival, but not just survival, as if just getting through. It's how to kind of make life be as rich as possible. And one of the wake-up calls, one of the things that come along is opportunity. So your doctor says to you, okay, you've got osteoporosis. Okay, you've got this. Okay, you've got that. Well, does that mean, you know, you take it and you just say, I'm worried and I don't know what to do? Or is it that you say to yourself, all right, let's greet this.
This is a chance.
This is a chance, a wonderful chance. So we're going to be back with you in just a couple of minutes, my friend. This is Armand DeMille. When I come back, I'll play you some beautiful music just because I think you deserve it. And then we'll continue. Thank you. Magic of John Coltrane. A little more of that later, my friends. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind. Touches my heart in certain places, as does Mark and the work that Mark is doing in this book. In case you just tuned in, this is Armand DeMille with the program The Positive Mind on WBAI 99.5 FM. Always available to you on the web at positivemind.com. You could always hear the archives. This program will be up. When You're Falling, Dive. The title of a book by Mark Matuszak. Mark has faced the demons and kind of looked at them and said, what's missing? And he's found a part of himself that he presents in this book about, you know, how do you live? How do you get through? And as a result of his own personal challenge, he interviewed many people, and people who were just faced with that very question, what now? Either do I give up, or do I deny it, or what now? Well, Mark's going to tell us a little more about how people got through this.
One amazing guy I spoke to was Francis Bach, who was a Sudanese Christian who was kidnapped at 7 years old by an Arab marauder. They invade these villages and take people, captive. And he had to live for 10 years as a slave in this man's house. He lived in the pigsty. He ate with the animals. He was told if he did anything, if he made a wrong move, they would shoot him. And he spent 10 years actually.
From which age? At what age?
7 to 17.
Wow.
Yes. And he's a Christian, and he said that really his faith is what got him through. He said, better not to live than to live as a slave. And finally, when he was 17, he was able to escape. He got off this guy's farm, and he hitchhiked to Khartoum, and he was eventually an anti-slavery group adopted him, and he was brought to the United States. But this is a transformed human being. This is not. This is not like anyone you've met before. I've never seen such mercy in a man. Not in a cover-up saccharine kind of way, but he's truly found forgiveness in his heart for these people. And it's not the forgiveness of whitewashing. It's the forgiveness of, if I don't let go of this anger, it will kill me. I will not have a life if I cannot get past this anger. So he says it's a struggle. He's not a saint, but he's a true teacher. I mean, he is a true teacher.
Well, in a way, you know, in a way, he's saying, and I'm sure he understands it, that to be trapped in resentment is to truly be the slave.
It is.
That's where the enslavement is. That I think it was. I forgot who it was that said, "Free men, you can't set a man free. A free man has to set himself free in order to be truly free." And what he's doing is he's saying, you know, I must free myself. And freeing yourself is getting out of those resentments, because resentments for persecution, and say you have a right to be angry.
Sure.
That's okay.
Sure.
You don't have to forgive the person and go over and say, oh, it's all okay. Thank you very much for feeding me.
No,
you don't have to do that. But the thing in your heart is to let it go.
That's right. I mean, forgiveness, it's like surrender and resignation. They're not the same thing. Forgiveness and condoning are not the same thing. Forgiveness is a selfish act. Forgiveness is the act of releasing your anger so that you can live, so that you can move forward, so that you're not, like you say, a slave of this experience.
You know, one of our people who work here, Cindy Brialata, also says that an important, essential part of almost every one of these things that you go through is not only forgiveness of, for example, blaming cigarette companies or blaming alcohol or blaming your parents, but forgiveness of self seems to be an essential part, too.
Yes.
In this being able to maintain your soul through a survivorship.
I honestly think it's the first step. I don't know that you can actually forgive anyone else if you're holding yourself hostage that way. There needs to be at least an element, not a complete, it's not black or white. We're imperfect, contradictory beings in progress, in process. But if you don't begin to let yourself off the hook, how can you possibly forgive anybody else? And how can you possibly love? How can you create? How can you have passion if you are holding yourself hostage that way to blame or to mistakes? We all make mistakes.
So people who smoke cigarettes, who wind up getting an illness, and people who have lived a certain sexual lifestyle, who wind up getting disease, the first way they're holding themselves hostage is they blame themselves.
Absolutely.
Now, that removes you from yourself.
It does.
Kind of a funny thing. One of the men I know, Mark, who described it as follows. He said, there's a child inside each one of us that we are the ones who need to embrace this child. It's like the first step. When we are critical of that child, then we're actually creating the war inside of ourselves, and there's no possible way of finding the real you. You just got this war between the parent inside you and you.
That's right. That's right. Your heart is closed. And you can't live with it. I mean, you can survive with a closed heart, but you can't really live.
But there are some things. I have a friend, Mark, who was in Germany, and he was a psychiatrist, and his wife was, he married this woman who he thought was not too stable, but they had a son, and he was sticking around for the son's sake. And he eventually did get a divorce. And when he got the divorce, it was within weeks. She backed up a car and ran over his son and killed him. No.
Oh, my God.
It was an accident of her hysteria. She wasn't watching. Wow. He killed his son, died. He knew he didn't want to leave because he wanted to protect his son, and he left, and his son died. Mm. So now, I mean, here's this man who was a professional man who had, I mean, who was one of the most highly developed humans to start with. He quit everything. Mm. He went to another country. Mm. He bought a farm. He lived on that farm, and he stayed in solitude for years until he could find the place where he could shine. And when I say shine, he's now one of the great spiritual leaders of the world, you know.
Yeah,
he's a beautiful guy. Death of a child. You have a story with that.
Yeah, I do. But before I was just going to say that that's the stark choice that someone in that kind of an extreme situation faces. Either they shut down and start to die, or they have to go into a spiritual awareness. If they don't, they're backed in the corner. So that's a beautiful.
So where
story.
Am I? So you know, we know of a lot of couples where a husband and wife, you know, are so bonded together. The wife dies and the husband dies within a year.
Yes.
Something happened there, something where the man said, well, okay, I'm not going to try to take this one on.
Right.
Instead of, okay, here's the next step.
Right.
And it's almost it's like it's for me and you, Sadie, we're going to take the next step.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. And who's to say it's not right for those people? Some people are done.
Yeah.
They don't, it's... but
well, I don't know. I don't know, Mark. Let me ask you about that.
Yeah.
Because some people may be done because it's too inconvenient not to be done, and it's easier to die.
Right.
That doesn't mean you're really done. It's just easier to die. And some people, you're perfectly all right to take an easy path.
Right, right. I mean, it's sort of moot, isn't it, if they lead to the same decision?
It is moot.
Are you done? If you're not willing to put the effort in or go through the pain or change, you're done for all intents and purposes. Although,
well,
from an absolute point of view, from God's perspective, maybe you're...
But many people want to be done.
Yes,
many people who have a latent depression.
Absolutely.
You know, give me a reason to get out of here.
Absolutely.
You know, let me go. And
absolutely. This book starts with my sister coming to me shortly before she committed suicide and asking me, how do you live? And this was a question. I was only 20 at the time. She was 30. I had never thought of that question before in my life. But that's where she was, exactly what you're describing. How do you live? How does a person survive his own life? How, with all of the pain and the loss and the inevitable, you know, destination, how do you have a life? And that's an extreme version of, I think, of the choice that we're all facing all the time.
What was that like for you, that moment?
It was a strange moment for me.
Tell me.
I was only 20.
Right.
I hadn't asked myself that question myself. And I tried to cheer her up. I didn't have an answer. I said, you do. You have to keep going. To me, failure wasn't an option. Or surrender.
Right, because you're the guy who grew up without a dad.
Exactly.
Who is now the hero of the family.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. So this, to me, was not only scary, but anathema. What she was saying was something to be avoided at all costs, the voice inside that was saying, I'm really scared and I don't know if I can do this. So I honestly didn't know what to tell her, and I sort of, you know, I tried to cheer her up in a superficial way, and it didn't do any good. Not that I could have saved her life, but I've often asked myself, what if I had steered her into therapy, or what if I had known something about spiritual life at that time and been able to direct her? But I didn't, I couldn't. And
what was your reaction immediately, since at the time of 20, you were lost in that kind of narcissistic, grandiose world of yours? So, you know, you were like, you weren't really much on the planet.
No.
From your own description of yourself.
No. I was completely conflicted because I loved her. She had actually raised me more or less when I was a kid. My mom was an absent mother largely. And so I adored my sister, and it was repulsive to me what had happened to her. It wasn't all her own fault. She'd been betrayed. She had a nervous breakdown. She'd been released from the hospital prematurely because the insurance wouldn't pay. She should not have been out on her own reconnaissance. But still, to admit to that kind of defeatism and that kind of despair and depression to me was horrible. I wanted to run. I wanted to get as far away from it as I could. But my heart, but I loved her, and so I was very conflicted.
So how did you deal? What happened when you heard the word your sister died?
What happened?
What happened to you? Yeah.
What happened?
Did it break through then? Because you said it broke through later when you found out about your own illness.
No, it didn't actually. I was too young. I was angry, and I found I was
blaming.
I was enraged at her ex-husband. I was angry at my mother, who had encouraged her to go back to work before she was really able to. I was pointing the finger because I couldn't deal with the collapse of the impossible happening at that age. I was just too young.
And I see it now, though. I see that now, after you've kind of dealt with yourself, when you go back there to think of the feeling of it, it brings you right to the feelings now, doesn't it?
It does. It really does.
I see the tear in your eye.
It is. Yes. Yeah. You asked about Maria Houston, who lost her daughter. She's a wonderful woman. She, about 15 years ago, her 2-year-old daughter was diagnosed with kidney cancer. And Maria, who was sort of a New Jersey soccer mom, beautiful, everything right, the perfect house, the perfect home, had to go through this dark night of the soul, and her daughter died almost a year to the day after her diagnosis. And in the course of her dying, before she became Maria's teacher. She was one of these wise children, and you know, the child will become father to the man. Well, she actually did leave Maria with a whole different way of looking at her life and herself. She eventually wrote a book about it called Hannah's Gift. And the subtitle of the book is telling. It's Lessons from a Life Fully Lived.
Mm.
And the girl died at 3 years. You know, she was 3 when she died. And Maria has not been the same since then. And one of the things that she's done is devoted herself to the grief and grieving movement, and something that we don't understand a lot about in this country.
Do you understand from what she's kind of told you? Is the essence of the movement that we need to kind of understand.
Well, that grief is a force. It's a power that has heft. It's like gravity. They come from the same root. And grief can be used to get honest with yourself, to wipe out the things that aren't working for you, to ask yourself the questions you wouldn't ask yourself before. Because there's no, how she puts it, is that in deep grief, there's no room for anything but the truth. And so it has a clarifying effect. And she used the grief of losing her daughter to end a bad marriage, to start writing, to leave New Jersey, where she didn't want to be at the time. And it actually became a boon for her. Not that she doesn't miss Hannah and wouldn't have her still here, but she can't deny the blessings that came out of this horrible experience. And there are a lot of people who are grieving, who don't know what to do with the feelings. And this book is for those people. It's for people to realize that they're not useless, futile, wasted feelings. They are feelings with power, with tremendous power. It's dark power, but it's power that can be used for the good. It's power that can be used to open you open your heart and open your mind and move you forward in directions that you really wouldn't have dared go before.
You know, it's an interesting story, and here's one I'm sure you're going to use at some point in your life. They did a study about the geese up in Canada, about why the geese in Canada, when they're flying, have this cry that sounds very much like a human cry. And so they were studying the geese, and they have a sound that it just sounds like a human crying, so they studied it, and they learned that when the geese are in formation and they're traveling south, if one goose falls out of formation, the other geese set up that cry, and the cry is to find out where that goose is, because they don't know what to do with the formation. Because you need the formation to create the downdraft so that they could all fly along a distance. So they set up this cry, and they find out whether or not that goose is going to come back in formation. If the goose doesn't come back in formation, they reform the formation.
Right.
Now, I take this as a very important lesson about grief. That grieving and the crying of grieving is about trying to determine, is that gone? Or is it not gone? Need I reform my formation? You know, is this where I've got to go? Have I got to kind of get myself to change a little bit, accepting the loss of that?
Right.
Grief, as you're describing it and as she describes it, is the same thing. When you're falling, when you're in grief and you feel this horrible, terrible grieving sensation, there's two opportunities. One is to dive into it. Go into that thing.
Right.
It's only an abyss.
That's right.
Right? Get into the bottom of that thing. Find the bottom of that hole. Go through it.
Right.
And not, don't anticipate I'm going to come out the other side, because you will come out the other side.
That's right. That's right.
But you can't hold on to anything. You can't hold on to the ropes. You got to let it go.
You have to. Winston Churchill said, if you're going through hell, keep going.
It's true.
There's no, I mean, you can either stop and freeze and die while you're still alive, or you can move through the dark. And
One of our heroes, Ram Dass, and I know I had a little time with Ram Dass myself, a little bit about your experience with him, because you co-authored a book with him.
I co-edited recently, right? Well, Ram Dass, Richard Alpert, had a stroke something like 12 years ago, and he was in the middle of a book about aging, conscious aging. He said he wanted to do for aging what, for the boomers, what he had done for the flower children in the 60s. So sort of give them be a point man, be a sort of pilot fish for this generation. So he had written this, you know, he was partly finished with the manuscript, and he had a major hemorrhage, which led to a stroke, which left him with 10% chance of survival. Well, he did pull through, but he needed to finish this book about aging. So paradoxically, the book became about what he was experiencing. And it changed radically after he had the stroke. One of the things he said to me is he had spent 40 years as a humanitarian helping other people, but it wasn't until he needed to be helped himself and served himself, when you can't go to the bathroom alone, make yourself a sandwich alone, that he truly discovered what spiritual practice is about. It was the hardest thing he had ever been through. And that's when he realized the other side of aging, that unless you are – aging calls on many of the principles, you know, you learn about in spiritual practice, surrender and compassion and unconditional love. And these are the kinds of things we need. The less we have materially, and as the body changes, the more the psyche and the heart need to evolve. He said to me, he said, when everything else is taken away, wisdom alone remains, which I thought is gorgeous, and that's really become one of my mantras in life. Everything can be taken away from you, but dignity and wisdom.
My guest, Mark Matusik, the book which comes out tomorrow, you're going to do a book signing tomorrow?
On the 14th at Barnes & Noble in Tribeca.
Great, July 14th. When You're Falling, Dive. An interesting man to go meet, my friends. Mark Matusik. So I guess the essence of it, it gets down to as well, you know, the two sides of it, Mark. You know, kind of what you discovered is we're in charge of everything. We also have to be willing to let go of being in charge.
Yeah, right. That's right. It's a middle path.
Have you done that?
I'm doing my best. I'm doing my best. It's a work in progress. I don't expect to be finished. You know, I don't expect to have mastered anything. I find that I have less fear. I have fewer expectations and fewer fixed expectations about things. And I love my life more. I'm really, truly grateful for my life. Someone I talked to in the book says that gratitude is a very profound spiritual practice. And it is. It's truly, it becomes a way of blessing the self and blessing your own life. And that's a lot different than walking around thinking about how the world's done you wrong and all the things you don't have and you know, George Bush.
I want to thank you. As I said, Mark Matuzik, When You're Falling, Dive. This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. I will be back with you on Tuesday at 1 p.m., my friends. Tuesday at 1 p.m. with a little more of this. One more thing I wanted to ask you. The name of the other book, the book before it?
Yeah. My first book was called Sex, Death, Enlightenment, and the second book is called The Boy He Left Behind.
The Boy He Left Behind. Back with you on Tuesday, my friends, at 1 p.m., closing with some more John Coltrane.